Hello, sports fans, and welcome to another edition of Yesterday Sports on the Sports History Network.
And make sure to check out sportshistorynetwork.com/giveaways. I have two signed books I'm giving away. One is titled No Nonsense, Old School Weight Training, and the other is Reliving 1970s Old School Football.
Blog Talk Radio.
Tonight we'll go back in time to seasons past, when 22 men graced the rugged fields of yesterday, fighting for one more first down, one more yard gain, one final score which would bring victory, 60 minutes of battle on the gridiron. Tonight, we'll explore the world of gridiron greats. Welcome to Gridiron Greats, football history and its memorabilia, on the Gridiron Greats Publishing and Broadcasting Network. In conjunction with Swick Enterprises, and we're live from the South Fork, North Carolina home of Gridiron Greats Magazine. I'm Bob Swick, publisher and editor of Gridiron Greats Magazine, and I'll be your host for the show. Gridiron Greats is the only publication in America that focuses upon the history and memorabilia of the North American football game since its inception in 1869. We'll cover 150-plus years of football history and memorabilia. You'll find us on the web at GridironGreatsMagazine.com. It is at this time I'd like to introduce my co-host. He's a senior contributing writer to Gridiron Greats Magazine, a football memorabilia historian, specializing in pre-World War II items, in particular Red Grange, and also Seattle Seahawk items, in particular Steve Largent. He hails Portland, Oregon. Mr. Joe Squires. Joe, welcome to the show.
Bob, good. So good to be back. Seems like it's been a while, but man, just talking football with you is such a pleasure.
Actually, it's been almost 4 weeks. I didn't realize where the time went, it was interesting. I was commenting to Brenda this morning. I said, you know, we wake up, it's Monday morning, and the next thing we know, it's almost Friday, 5 o'clock at night, and I just don't know where the time goes. And I'm not even working full-time, even though I'm doing a lot of different projects and stuff. And I'm still teaching part-time. But I just don't know where time goes. It's really amazing, to say the least. Mm. But in any event, I'm glad we're back. And I'm going to get right into what we're going to talk about before our special guest comes on. We are going to look at a few truly amazing auctions that we really briefly discussed before the show. And I'm going to lead off with the GOAT, Tom Brady, again, and a 2000 playoff contenders autographed ticket card which has a Beckett grade of 8.5 with the autograph at 10, which is currently up for auction, and it's apparently at a half a million and rising. Comments?
Yeah. Well, you got to roll that off the tongue a little bit, Bob. It's the 2000 playoff contenders Tom Brady championship ticket, rookie number 144. Because if it doesn't have the championship, it's about a tenth of the price. I know. Gone are the days where you say the Steve Largent rookie card and people are like, oh, Topps, 1977, Topps, number 177. Oh, yeah, and we all agree. Because the 2000 playoff contenders rookie ticket has a rookie ticket variation and then the championship rookie ticket variation. They look exactly the same except for the word championship written in cursive above rookie ticket. But I digress on the wide playing field we have of, you know, rookie ticket. And this isn't even just the Tom Brady SP, 2000 SP rookie ticket, which most people thought was his rookie. Anyways, Heritage has. Go ahead.
Clarify for me, what was the one that went in Leland's auction? Was it this similar card or was it that other card?
Correct. The championship rookie. Yeah, so the 2000 playoff contender rookie ticket is, there's about 1,000 of those. The championship ticket, they're numbered 1 to 100.
Okay.
So, and this one's number 95 out of 100. So there's just 100 of the championship rookie tickets. And there's a little bit of a tint to it, you know, so you can kind of tell what it is. Yes. This is the championship rookie ticket that went in Leland's for the record, what was it, $2.3 million?
Right.
This one's in about similar shape. It's graded by Beckett, you know, which is they love. It's an 8.5 for the condition of the card and a 10 for his autograph. I'm kind of old school like you. I look at Tom Brady's autograph and it looks crappy. If I didn't know that was Tom Brady, if it wasn't on Tom Brady's card, I would have no idea that's his autograph. Obviously very subjective grading his autograph. Who knows? But this is in Heritage. It's got 14 days left. It's at 470,000, which is 564 including the VIG.
Now I'm curious, if there's only 100 of these cards, would you speculate in any way, shape, or form that some collector with unlimited resources is trying to hoard them?
Do you
think in any way, shape, or form, that could be a possibility? I was thinking about it this afternoon, I was doing a little research, and I'm saying to myself, okay, there are 100. What's to say somebody wants to get 10 of them and dollar average them out at a $1.5 million each, that's only $15 million, you know, to somebody who has, again, who's worth a couple hundred million dollars, $15 million and 10 Brady cards, obviously, they can do it. But I don't know if I'm completely off base on it or not. And since we don't know who owns them, it's interesting to see what's actually going to happen with that one. But, the new card craze, it is relevant because he is still playing, yada, yada, yada. I mean, we talked this, so we're blue in the face with regards to where it's going to end up will be interesting again. My prediction is around 1.5, 1.6 with the juice.
Yeah.
I don't know if I could be way off on that, but because it's an 8.5 and it's a Beckett, it's going to get less than the PSA grade then.
I agree with you. That's almost verbatim where I was thinking, Bob, because, you know, to me, it's so subjective grading the autograph. What's more important, the grade of the card or the grade of the autograph? All of the autographs look like crap. So it's obviously very subjective. So to me, the grade of the card is what counts here. And the 8.5 versus the 9, totally agree with you. Beckett versus PSA or SGC, or SGC doesn't grade the, there isn't one. But, there it is. I mean, and plus, I think I'm going to quote you on that many times. I chuckled when you said, somebody's trying to corner the market. I mean, it's only 15 million. Your quote was, it's only 15 million to help corner this.
Right.
I don't know anyone who's got the firepower to do that.
I have a more than less than mentality. So we'll figure someone's got deep pockets. They got 15 million to burn. And rather than buying a couple condos in Turks and Caicos or whatever, they prefer the cards, so be it.
Yep.
Second auction item on our list here, and I was floored when I saw this one.
Yeah.
A 1955 top All-American Jim Thorpe in a PSA 9 grade for $1,000? What is going on?
Yeah.
I'm shocked.
Yep, I wouldn't have believed it either, Bob. Seriously. Yeah. Is that, in your opinion, is that a 55 Tops All-American collector trying to, you know, raise the average of their set, or is that a Jim Thorpe collector? Which has the bigger draw, or is it both?
My gut feeling, it's got to be somebody on the registry trying to increase the numerical value of their set. And, they want that number one 55 All-American set graded, obviously, in the highest grades possible. And again, I when I was collecting this set, and I will say this, I saw more better grade 55 All-Americans than I did a lot of other vintage sets from the 1950s. So realistically, it's probably not a touched-up card. It was probably a card that was preserved over the years. And for whatever reason, those 55 All-Americans, between some pack finds and people, for whatever reason, saving them, ended up in a lot better condition than other sets of the 1950s. My gut feeling, reiterating PSA registry set, somebody's going for broke. And what's $63,000? You know, again, it's just an amazing price. But again, does it, and I'll throw this out, we talked about this numerous times in the past, does that put pressure on any other grades? Or is that only pressure is found in the higher grade and or ungraded and in a near mint condition? I still am mystified by that. You know what I mean?
Oh, but I don't think I've told you the story, but probably like, you know, 10, 11 years ago, I had a dealer, friend of mine, come crash at my house for a couple of days. And this is when I was collecting every set possible. And he went through every single card of mine, you know, almost 10,000 cards, and looked at every single card and then set them aside if he thought they were bump worthy. So he ends up walking out of my house with about 600 cards that he thinks could be bumped, takes them to PSA personally, submits them for a regrade, and of the 600, about 350 got bumps. One of those bumps was a 55 AA Jim Thorpe. And then I had the choice. I could keep it and pay him a small commission, or I could sell it. And I decided to sell that one. And I was stunned.
Wow.
For $3,000-$4,000.
Wow.
This was 10 years ago, probably. So I had one of these Thorpes a long time ago. And so I hate to say it, when I see something like this pop for 63, I just shake my head and go, dang it, I used to have one of these.
Exactly. Oh. Third card on our list, 1961 Fleer, which is sometimes an unloved set. PSA 9 grade, Mr. Jim Brown of the Cleveland Browns.
Yeah.
And how much did I end up going for? Because I'm confused here. It was $27,500 or
$27,500? $27,500. Sorry about that.
Okay.
Yeah, I forgot to put
all right.
Fleer
okay.
there.
Because I was looking
61.
On one. Go ahead.
Oh, obviously, I've talked about the 61 Fleer, just one of my favorite Fleer sets. I mean, just love the picture, love the history behind it, you know, knowing the games that were taken at. Split into two series with the AFL second series, NFL first series. And the second series, AFL, so much more common than the NFL. And maybe they were collected more. Maybe the second series by the time it rolled around, I don't know. I've got uncut sheets and they're all on the same, the AFL, they're seriesed on the sheets. So who knows, maybe second series was printed more, maybe it was coveted more, you know, who knows. But when I was putting together my 61 Fleer set, Jim Brown was one of those cards I never found in a high grade. I had it in a PSA 8, but I could never find it in a PSA 9. Very rare card. Really tough to get. First series NFL 61 Fleer, but still 27.5. I mean, beautiful card. Iconic player, obviously. You know, doesn't get better.
Now, to me, that card was probably bought by a registry person. That's my gut feeling. To push it to that level, that's the only rational argument I can make for seeing that kind of price on it. And it's interesting you say, because my 61 Fleer set is in relatively nice shape, but my Jim Brown, I graded, you know, a VGEX X- card. And I really never saw over the years, going through my notes on 61 Fleer, especially for the stars, I never really saw a lot of near-mint star cards from that set. I saw more near-mint commons from that set. So that's interesting. And again, it could be the sheet configuration on it as to why that's either on or off and the grading and why we really can't find any.
Here's another metric. I've got probably eight uncut sheets of 61 Fleer second series AFL. I have zero NFL uncut sheets series 1 61 Fleer. So, I mean, I don't – yeah, it's – something's up, how it was printed, how it was distributed, whatever, but, you know, way more common to find the second series AFL.
Yeah. And then the last card we're going to briefly mention is a 1950 Bowman. Otto Graham, number 45, and that was a PSA 9?
Yep.
Or 8? Okay.
Yep.
PSA 9, $113,000 plus. You get, I don't understand that in any way, shape, or form. I really don't. That's an amazing price for that card.
Yeah, I'm looking at, I have all four uncut sheets from the 1950 Bowman set hanging framed in my office. I just looked over my shoulder, and I'm looking at that autogram, wondering if I could slice that out of there. that's a lot. I remember, 15 years ago, a friend of mine, ended up being a friend, Keith Winslow. He lives up in Alaska. He bopped in and he bought a PSA 9 autogram for $30,000. I remember at the time I was like, wow, that's a lot. But he collected the best of the best. He just wanted the iconic cards. I mean, here we are. We're seeing these things appreciate. And, as we were mentioning pre-show, it's like this isn't even his rookie card. There's a 1946 Sears, Sears and Roebuck. I have that uncut sheet framed. It's sitting to the left of me. I could reach out my fingers and touch it. I can see Otto Graham is in the upper right portion of that sheet. That's his rookie card to me, but that's a regional issue. So not mainstream. So it's not his rookie card, but that's a lot of money. Yeah. That's more than I paid for my first house.
Unbelievable.
Yeah.
Unbelievable.
Yeah.
And then within the last few minutes before our guest comes on, you want to, make a little mention again on the 1935 National Chickle sheet and set.
Yeah. It's I on our VFC, our vintage football, and I'm constantly thinking about uncut sheets, and I was just asking if anyone has ever seen a miscut 1935 Chickle card. The way we started piecing together the 48 leaf sheet, 10 years ago, was I was collecting miscuts of them, and you start seeing what the border, what the adjacent cards are when they're horribly miscut. You can start piecing it together, and once you start seeing a couple patterns, the dominoes fall pretty quick. So I just was asking if anyone has ever seen a miscut card, and the answer is no, except for a George Keneally card. I get the feeling this was printed in, six rows of four, 24 sheets, or 24 cards to a sheet with, number 25 through 36, as a short print on the second sheet or something. So I get the feeling these weren't numerically ordered. I get the feeling they're randomly placed on the card or on the sheet. But the mystery is still out there, but it's, that's what we love about our hobby is, those long tail mysteries. So, the investigation still carries on looking for clues on that 35 uncut sheet. So if anyone listening has any miscut cards that show adjacent cards, I'm all ears.
And I did mention before, on the board there, in all the years I've collected this and going through my notes on it, I never saw a miscut 35 sickle card. And that's interesting because the ones I pretty much, have handled over the years were from the 60s, 70s, and the early 80s. I really never saw a lot of miscut cards from the 1950s. And my theory is if there were they actually thrown out at the time of production when they were being cut, and or were collectors saying, hey, I don't want this card half and half, I'm going to throw it out. So I don't know. It's very interesting. If any of our audience has this, please contact us, and I will definitely put you in touch with my co-host, Christopher Clark. All right, our special guest is here, and I'd like to get him on the show. He has been a guest on our show. This is now his fourth time, from 2012, 17, and 21. He is the author of 8 books, with his current book being a biography on Branko Nagurski, which was published by Roman and Littlefield. He was a former writer for my old Football Times newsletter in the 1990s, and he's also head of the research library of NFL films. I'd like to welcome a good friend of ours, Mr. Chris Willis, to our show. Chris, welcome to the show this evening.
It's a pleasure to be here, Bob and Joe, to talk some more football. So thanks for having me on.
And a couple of things before we get started. I want to mention to our audience, Chris and I were able to have a very quick visit at the Atlantic City National, where he was there passing through. We had a brief talk, many different things, but it was nice to see you, Chris. It's been a while. And to put you on the spot, to lead off, do you remember when you were writing for Football Times, my old newsletter, do you remember what issue and or year your first article was published in?
Wow. I know we've mentioned it before. It had to be 93,
92? Oh, my gosh.
Or was it 94? Was it 94? Okay, yeah, okay. I thought it might have been around 93, 94. So, I had just picked it up and started reading. I was like, this is pretty cool. I mean, I think you had Sports Collector's Digest at the time, but this was just about football. So it was fun to start reading. And then I sent you an article or two, and you liked them, you published them. I was like, this is great. Had fun doing it.
To further put you on the spot, I'm going to read in my column, which was Random Thoughts, your introduction. It began, I would like to welcome the Football Times, Chris Willis, the new writer, specializes in Hall of Fame players and Hall of Fame memorabilia. He has an impressive collection of Hall of Fame-related items in his own personal collection. I'm sure you will enjoy his articles. And your first two articles was Hall of Fame Collecting and Hall of Fame Programs. You had an 8 page spread in that issue. Yeah, that issue is rare. It's beyond rare because I only have my own copy, and there weren't a real lot of them out there. So it could be pretty high on the aftermarket if it ever comes to auction or whatever.
Sure.
But anyway,
absolutely.
Thanks for being on, Chris. I appreciate it.
Yeah.
And to lead off, I know we've talked about this before, but if you could refresh our audience's memory, can you please let them know how you became a fan of football again and the history of football?
Yeah, I think for me, growing up in Ohio, especially Columbus, Ohio, right there near Ohio State, you sort of gravitate to college football and football in general. And then my dad owned a used bookstore, so, reading – football books in the sports section, was the next sort of step in my learning about football history. And so those combinations, definitely made me feel, pretty good about, being a football fan and learning about football history, You can't get any better than that. So that's where I sort of got started. The love of football, you know, watching Ohio State and then, you know, the Browns and the Bengals and then, you know, reading a lot about the game and the history, through my dad's store.
That's pretty cool. I like it. Oh, Bob, did we lose you?
Stop. I'm here. I'm sorry.
It'll come back.
And so, Chris, again, well, you know, your background and your history is perfect in a way to be a writer and handing off to Joe this new book. Joe.
Yeah. Hey, I remember the last time you were on, you were writing, you know, about Bronco Nagurski. You know, you said you actually were in contact with his son. A lot of the stories you got came from him. Just really cool provenance of the, you know, the stories you were getting and the subject. But, I still love your Red Grange book. How did you settle on Nagurski? Why Bronco? Why him?
Yeah, it was actually from Red. You know, I had reached out to Tony Nagurski, the oldest son of Bronco. When I was doing the Grange research, and I was able to interview him, and we talked a little bit, you know, just get a little more insight. And he read the Grange book and liked it. So yeah, he reached out to me, you know, thinking maybe we could do something together for his father, you know, Bronco. And, you know, so I wasn't planning on writing, you know, but when we sat down and talked and he had some of the material, he brought a little bit of copies of the material and I liked it. And I was like, you know,
mm-hmm.
He had four other children living. So, you know, was able to get a lot of insight, you know, so I think that combination led to me like, okay, let's do this. It was unfortunate that when I was really getting into the research, COVID hit, so I couldn't travel very much. So I was lucky that he was able to send me, you know, through the mail, you know, all the material and stuff. So, and do the interviews over the phone, you know, things like that. But, travel wasn't, you know, all that great. So that's how I got started with it, and the project just developed. And then, like I said, it came out. It's been out, you know, it came out last month in August. So we're, you know, starting to get it out there and sort of hopefully to a younger fan base who might not know who Bronco is,
yep,
or even to Bears fans or Minnesota fans or just general fans, to tell the story, you know, in a unique way.
Yeah.
And I
love it.
I want to comment that this was the type of book, when I got it in the mail that night, I pretty much was up pretty late because I couldn't put it down. And you know, I'm not trying to, you know, pump the book for you or try to increase sales or whatever, but in all honesty, the flow of the book was just incredible. And mm-hmm. I was just so fascinated by this man's life and how I was trying to think of a good word to describe him, but how precise he was in his life. And he had this foresight. In my opinion, he wanted his family to be financially secure. He was a man of very, very modest means. I just wish every NFL player today would read this book and understand this is the history of the sport. This is why you're doing what you're doing today. This is why you're making the money you're making. Because guys,
yes,
like this put it all on the line for $250 a game, $250 cash a game. And they had no problem doing it. They had no problem living in a boarding house or,
yep,
in a hotel for the season. And they gave it their all, and they wanted to win. And that was their biggest concern, winning and helping the team. And it was a team effort. And I think, Chris, you really eloquently stated that through the entire book. And you couldn't just help. Man, I really wish I could have talked to this guy while he was alive. You know, I it's just incredible, truly incredible. And one part of the book, kind of getting off script here, but when he had the Super Bowl, he tossed the coin at the Super Bowl back in the 78 or the 79?
After the 83 season, Super Bowl 18.
Okay.
Yep.
Okay, so Super Bowl 18, he gets a call from the NFL, and they ask him if he'd be willing to do it, and he said, I'll do it on one condition that my entire family can accept.
Yep.
That, I mean, that just blew me away that this man is concerned about his sons and daughters and their spouses, and he wants the entire family to share in that kind of festivity. And it was just so cool to read, and it was just a breath of fresh air to read this and just to say, this is the football I like. You know what I mean? This is not the football I try to watch last night's game, and I ended up turning the sound off, okay? I couldn't take it anymore. So, you know, I basically watched the game with no sound. And, you know, I don't get it. I really don't get it. But perfect analysis of that time frame of the man. To me, it's probably your best book to date. Not to give you a small head, but is a credible book.
No, I appreciate that. I mean, that's part of wanting to preserve these type of stories is, you know, the early years and these early, you know, stars and players, you know, that might not get their due quite, you know, today, or even just the recognition and you know, some recognition and you know, some honors and stuff like that. So so it's nice to hear that you enjoyed it. And, you know, because I said this story is really, really cool, and it's, you know, it's a nice story, you know, and things like that. So, I mean, there's many more out there, you know, that can be told. So this is just part of some of these type of stories of, you know, that era and stuff. So it's nice to hear that you enjoyed it and appreciated that type of story.
It's a feel-good story, in my opinion, and it just makes me proud. I'm really proud that the story has been preserved, and I'm sure the family loves the book, too, at the same time. And I'm just proud to say, you know, I'm a real small part. Joe's a real small part. Everybody involved in Gridiron Greats magazine is a small part of trying to preserve stories like this and the time frame of where these guys played, because they have no clue. And can you imagine? I mean, think about this. I really never knew to the extent until I read the book of how advanced he was in his wrestling career. I knew he wrestled, but I had no concept of the, you know, the in-depth and the amount of wrestling that this guy did and played football at the same time. I mean, it's amazing to me. And again, he's concerned about financial security for his family, and it's just a great story to look at. Unbelievable.
Yeah, that was part of the book that that I was interested in as much as anything, too, because obviously it's more of a football story, and I focused on that a little bit more. And there's enough if you're a wrestling fan, you know, there's just three or four chapters even on the wrestling itself, and you get to learn a little bit more of that, because there's more detail to that part of it, you know, like I said, but you can only write so many pages. It can't be 500-600 pages, so. You know, so but the wrestling part was very impressive, because, like you mentioned, he did do it at the same time. You know, he started, you know, wrestling in 1933, which is right, you know, during his fourth year, I think, in the NFL. And then 37, he wins the world championship, heavyweight world championship. And then he's got even more responsibilities that entire year. And I don't think I realized how much he did in 37. Like, in the fall, right. I mean, there were weeks where he would, you know, he would wrestle – in like Salt Lake City on Tuesday, he would, you know, do Denver on Thursday, and then he would go to Chicago, you know, Friday into Saturday, play the game on Sunday, and then maybe the next Tuesday have to go wrestle in New York. Like, that was a typical schedule, you know, throughout, especially September, October, the first 2 months of the season. That's what he did for every week, you know. Then House eventually won out and said, look, we're going for a championship here. We need you here. So then November, early December, I think he only wrestled like twice in the last month and a half. And they end up winning the Eastern Division. They lost to Sammy Ball in the championship game against Washington. But he was doing both. He was wrestling as the heavyweight champion and then playing fullback every Sunday to try to get the Bears to the championship. He got the Bears to the championship. They almost won, like, you know. So it's an unbelievable feat.
I love it.
Amazing.
Bob and I were talking before the show, Chris, and it's such a labor of love. I mean, you writing these books, I'm sure you're not getting rich off of them. So, I mean, it is just such an amazing gift to the hobby that you sit down and spend a lot of time writing such amazing books. And it reminds me of Bob doing the podcast here, Gridiron Greats. It's just we're lucky to have people like you in the hobby writing really amazing things like this for all of us to enjoy.
Oh, no, it's like I said, I thank you guys for, having me on and, to be able to talk a little bit about it, like I say, even if it's whatever the project is, so that's part of, being a part of that, sort of, like I said, the project going forward. So that's nice to be able to reach out to people, and people appreciate it. And that's always good.
Yeah. Quick follow-up question. I mean, now that you're done with Bronco Nagurski, I mean, I'd be remiss. I'm sure our listeners want to know, now that you've got all this free time, I'm sure, you now have the time available to get to work on that Steve Largent book.
Yeah, I know we've been talking about that, I think, since my first visit in 2012, so on the podcast. I think it's still on that, my index card of list of things to do, but, so we'll see.
Well, Chris, knowing that I asked in 2012, at least I'm, consistently a cheese dick. So
sure.
I got
sure.
that going for me.
Yeah. That's great. Well, getting back on script here, NFL Films, again, you've got a dream job. What do you actually do there?
I just work in the head archivist in the research library here, the producer's department. So, each project that's done, if there's any research to be done, I just help out with that and then help with scripts. I do a little bit of editing, not much, but, anytime I can pinch hit with that. So so just anything to help the producers get their material they need to make their shows better. So that's kind of what to do.
So give us an example of that. Like a couple of years ago, the NFL turned 100 and they came out with that amazing commercial where a history of NFL in a banquet tossed around. I mean, there's some bumper, videos that play where it starts off with Red Grange running and then switches over to Peyton. I mean, is that the kind of stuff, or give us an example?
No, it'd be like, if you seen the schedule just came out for A Football Life. Like, so if you watch our Football Life shows, like Joe Theismann is the first show. So those producers who worked on that, like if they, as soon as they get it, oh, it's greenlit, we're going to do the show. They might come to, hey, what do we have on Joe Theismann? So if it's books, magazines, publication articles and things like that, that might not be necessary, what you see on the internet or on Wikipedia. So I find that material and give it to them, and then they run with it. And then footage-wise, the same way, if they need footage of something, hey, we want some CFL footage of, well, we'll have to see if we have anything in-house, and then we go and look to see if we can find that, So that's type of the routine of helping the producers in their projects.
That's cool. That's like Bob said, that is a dream job. That's really cool. So you finished the book on Nagurski. You've got one on, Red Grange. I mean, these are amazing topics. I mean, you got very close to the Nagurski family. They were really forthcoming with some information. You have to come out of an experience like this with some really interesting stories about, research that you did for the book.
Yeah, I mean, it was pretty, like I said, it wasn't daunting, but, as you go through everything, but like I said, they had files, they had the letters, from Hallis, which was really unique, and some of the contracts and some of the scrapbooks. So it was neat to go through. Like I said, sometimes you can't use everything. So it might be a little daunting from that perspective. You're like, not every, I mean, the Grange book was probably more detailed than anything I've written. So, and I wanted it to be that way. I kind of fought for that, like, hey, I want it to be this length and I want to include all this stuff. Nagurski, we didn't go overboard in that way, but that's the thing. You just pick the best stuff that might tell the best story and obviously, like with Nagurski, Nagurski wasn't quite as prominent, so to speak, with like Grange. Grange did so many interviews, you know, so you're finding a lot more interviews and more stories. And, you know, I mean, Bronco was a little more quiet. So, but going through the research, like I said, it's always a challenge, but then it's always good to get those nuggets, like you said, whether it's about wrestling, whether it's about, you know, the Bears, you know, or a certain game, the sneaker game, whatever, and to sort of put that in print, you know, and find the best stuff and sort of lay it out, you know, in a good way. Like Bob kind of mentioned it, it flowed. You know, that's what I try to, cause that's kind of like how I would like to read, you know, is that it flows nicely. I can get from one chapter to the next chapter and still be a little excited about it. And it's not, you know, bogging down or it's too, you know, too detailed or something like that. So, so that's always a challenge, but it's, so with this one, it definitely worked out well.
Hey, you're right. I never thought about that. He was pretty quiet. I mean, Grange went on. He did, you know, broadcasting, you know, insurance. I mean, yeah, he was. I never thought about that. That's pretty interesting.
Yeah,
He was. He seemed to me to be just what a great man. That's the kind of guy you would like to emulate in life. You know, you want to be a fan of his. You know, no ego involved. He did what he had to do. Family was first. Religion was there. Phenomenal athlete. I mean, it's just what an amazing story. I was just really blown away by reading it. It was just really, really an incredible view of him that I really never. I'm really surprised at myself that I really don't. I didn't know a lot of these things in reading it, and as such, it was a great education for me, and it would be a great education for anybody reading it at the same time. Chris, do you have any other anything in work or any possible works at this time for another book, or are you just going to take a break on it?
No, I think I'm working on another project about the 20s and 30s, you know, about that era. It's more of a ranking book, so I think I'm going to sort of write the 50 greatest two-way players. You know, sort of covers in the first NFL's 25 years from like 1920 to 1944. Mm-hmm. So, because I think there's some players that get lost, you know, I mean, the rankings always, you know, can be debated, you know, and people will have their own opinions, which is good. You know, that makes, you know, for a good debate and stuff. So, but you know, there's some guys, I think they're getting lost. You know, that might, maybe you might, like, I love Guy Chamberlain, you know, so, but is that enough to write a complete book, you know, or you know, Ox Emerson, you know, or Vern Llewellyn, you know, but these books can, or this ranking, this type of book, I can do more than what you just see on Pro Football Reference or Wikipedia, you know, so,
right.
You know, so they're going to be some profiles. And so, that's the next project that, you know, to get through, and to give some of these players that, you know, maybe people don't quite know quite as well. I mean, obviously the Red Grangers are going to be on there, and the Don Hudsons,
yeah,
and Sammy Bolt. But then, like I said, you get the Vern Llewellyns and the Ward Cuffs and the Pop Lumpkin and those type of players on there too. So.
Sounds great.
How'd you come up with that topic? That's pretty interesting.
Yeah.
You know, I would imagine, you know, Chuck Bednarik is in there. You know, he's, you know, when I think of two-way players, he's actually one of the first ones that comes to my mind.
Yeah, he's actually not on the list. Because I'm really just doing from the first 25 years. So it's 1920 to 1944. So
gotcha.
It's really the two-way era. You know, it's guys, or it's the players that kind of all played both ways. So it cuts off like right before the All-America Football Conference and then unlimited substitution or in 1950. Because Bednarik was great. He's such a unique guy, but he did not play against entire rosters that were playing both ways. He was pretty much the only one doing it, you know, especially
you know,
later in his career. So same thing with like George Conner and Charlie, like, you know, eventually they only played one side of the ball. So I didn't want to compare somebody like Chuck Bednarik, who was the only one doing it, which is an impressive feat, but he didn't play against other guys in his era that was doing it at the same time. So that's why I made the cutoff in 1944 to do that. So Joe, I'm sorry to disappoint you.
No. The delay on the Largent book is disappointing. That's just more of a curiosity.
Okay.
unbelievable. Awesome. Man. What do you read? Do you have a book that you like? Because, I reread your Grange book about 2 years ago. I made it about halfway through. I'm sure a lot of people can relate with this. There's about 6 books on my nightstand with, various bookmarkers midway through. But I dig that book. I mean, there's just so many good football books. What do you read? What's your favorite book, author, genre? I mean,
For me, I would say the majority of what I read is nonfiction. I don't read too much fiction. So it's nonfiction, I'm a history buff, so I love history. I just finished David Moranis' book on Jim Thorpe, that just came out.
Ooh.
So anything that intrigues me history-wise, whether it's, it could be from Civil War to, presidential history to, something from the Roaring Twenties, or movies or something like that I'll tackle. Now football wise, I do love their earlier years. I'll pick up anything else. If there's something on, Belichick and the Patriots, I might read, but anything that's done, pre-merger, definitely interests me, now some of my favorite books, I think I might have mentioned this before on the show, but like 3 of my favorite books are oral histories, and they were done, somewhat close to each other, or at least 2 of them. One was Pro Football Rag Days by Bob Curran, and The Game That Was by Myron Cope, the old Steeler announcer, and it's interviews with like all the great guys of the early days. And then Richard Whittingham, who's one of my favorites, he wrote one, What a Game They Played, and he kind of did the same thing in 1984, but I really appreciate those because I would have loved to had the chance to sit down with Red Grange or Don Hutson or Sammy Ball, I just didn't have the chance to interview those guys, or like I wrote, about Dutch Clark. I would just love to sit down and talk to Dutch Clark, or Mel Hine or Johnny Blood, So those 3 are my favorites, oral history wise. And I enjoy that, reading those type of books, just to learn, from the people that, lived in and stuff. So, but for the most part, a lot of history, and like I said, it's all over the place, but if it's a history book, I could be intrigued by it.
Is there? Nobody knows who it is. Joe, are you there?
Yeah, I'm here.
Oh, did I blank it?
Okay.
Oops. Can you hear me? Oh, I'm sorry.
No, you were cutting out. All right. Chris, from all the books you wrote, I'm just curious, from my own thought, from my own knowledge, did you have a favorite book that you wrote of the 8 that you've written?
That's a tough one. I would say there's kind of 2 that are tied. They're kind of my 1 and 1A. And that's the first is the Joe Carr book.
Right. Okay.
Sort of not just the biography on him, being from my hometown of Columbus, but it sort of was, an homage to the 20s and 30s, the first 2 decades of how the NFL got started. And what they did through those first 2 decades. And then the Grange book, the Grange book was sort of a labor of love and, over many years. And that came out as well as I thought it would. So they're kind of like 1 and 1A.
Okay.
for me.
Sounds good. A wide variety of what you've written on, and again, each individual book to me, very, very well done with regards to, you know, really digging down and getting the information necessary to complete the book and make it very, very interesting and very readable at the same time. So you did a good job. One final question for you, and what we ask every guest, any advice for a beginning collector and, in your case, a beginning writer with sports and with football?
Yeah, I mean, writing definitely is pick something you love, you know, or something, you know, you have some passion for, because writing can be an artist or, you know, like a long process, and, you know, it can take you a while to do it, whether it's, you know, a couple years. So pick something that you enjoy, you know, because if you enjoy it, like I said, you're never going to get tired of it, you know, or feel like it's a chore. So I always sort of mention that, you know, for people who are thinking about writing, especially, and, you know, enjoy it. So start with that.
That sounds good. I know the feeling quite well, because I always said to myself when I wrote, especially when I wrote in high school, and my first few jobs in newspaper reporting, and back then you had to use a typewriter since there were no computers. You know, you got a blank piece of paper, you put it in the typewriter. Okay, what do I do now? Type of thing. And then you got to get those creative juices flowing. And I always say to myself, if I was a reporter now and I had a computer available to do my typing, how much easier my job would be, and B, how much more I would have been able to write as compared to with the little old tape recorder, cassette recorder, and try to transcribe what I interviewed the player or whoever by and making sure it was accurate, so on and so forth, listening to the same line probably 9-10 times to make sure it was correct. We've come a long way, to say the least. But great advice, Chris. I appreciate it. Where's your new book available from? I know I've seen it on Amazon.
Yeah.
I've seen it on Barnes & Noble.
Sure. It's on Amazon, and it's also on the publisher's website, which is Rowan & Littlefield. So ROWMAN.com, Rowan.com. You can also – and there's reviews and some features on there, so you can get a little bit more information about it. But those typical book websites, yes.
All right. If we send it to you, will you personalize it and autograph it for me?
If you have it, and you can send it along, and I'll be more than happy.
That's great. Chris, thanks for taking time out of your schedule and being on our show today.
No, thanks for having me, guys. I appreciate it. Thank you.
Okay.
Chris, always
we'll
love having you on the always love having you on the show, Chris. Thank you.
Okay. No, thank you.
Take care. Chris Willis, a very, very advanced football author, great information, and I'll tell you, I'm doing the review for the fall issue of Gridiron Greats right now on the book, and I like I said, it was the type of book I couldn't put it down. I basically read it in one night, and I was just floored after reading it. It was just an incredible story. And I kind of wish the man and actually talked to him, because he was an incredible athlete, incredible family man, incredible man of the community in Minnesota there. What a great guy. It's just incredible, truly incredible. All right, we got a few more minutes. Go ahead.
From the gas station, there's a very famous picture of him. So you talk about, you know, retiring into obscurity as a, you know, owner of a gas station. Pretty interesting.
Yeah, and he enjoyed waiting on people. He felt he was doing a service to his town.
Yeah.
And, you know, there's nothing wrong with that. That was a good thing. That was a real good thing he did.
Absolutely.
And he loved being on his farm there, you know, the family farm. He loved providing. He helped his sisters out with college. I mean, it's just a great American story, a great American sports story. Truly needs, the story needed to be told, and I'm glad Chris was the one to write it, because he did an excellent job on it. And then again, I highly recommend that book for our listeners and our readers of our magazine, and they'll see my review coming up. It's it's amazing. Now, getting back to Gridiron Grace Magazine, I do want to make an announcement because we're in the process of revamping our website. We are currently out of some of the early issues of Gridiron Greats. And again, for those people who don't know, Brenda and I took over the magazine at issue number 23. Frank Rose published issues 1 to 22. A couple of people have asked me at the National about certain issues, so on and so forth. Right now, we are out of some of the early issues. So we do not have available the complete back run that we normally offer. If you've never heard of our magazine, you want all the back issues we publish, you can buy it at a certain amount for a certain price. We're out of it right now. Some issues, I'm debating whether I'm going to go back and reprint some of those issues one way or the other. So I'll keep everybody posted on it. But again, if there's a certain issue you're looking for, contact me first or call us first, and we'll let you know if it's available or not. Then number two, again, issues 1 to 22 were published by Frank Rose. I mentioned this several times to several people at the National who are inquiring about it. The most rarest issues of Gridiron Greats magazine are issues number 1 and 2. Are very hard to find. And I tell people all the time, my advice is if you find the issue and it's within, if it's basically under $200 for issue 1 and under $150 for issue 2 to buy it, people are floored when I tell them that. But I say, you know, there weren't a lot printed and they're really not readily available from what I've seen. Other issues, issues 3 to 8, are a little more available, and then issues 9 to 22 are still to be readily available in the market. However, I do not have any back issues of 1 to 22. I just have our library copy here of issues 1 to 22 for our files from that. So I wanted to clear up that while we were on the air today, because I know several people have asked me. I got several emails from the show on it, and I just want to clarify that. All right, we're down to roughly 2 minutes, Joe. 2 minute warning, wrap up. I'm going to hand off to you. What'd you pick up on tonight's show?
Always an amazing guest. And like I said, doing the hobby heavy lifting by writing amazing books. Great guest, Chris Willis. Thank you for coming on. I always love the advice people give, you know, and Chris is, you know, basically, you know, do what you love. Follow your dreams, and that's real easy for the guy who works at NFL Films to say. The rest of us out here, you know, who read books about, you know, Nagurski, and he met the Nagurski family and works at NFL. I love it, but gosh, he's getting near to be, you know, we need to start working on a Mount Rushmore of the hobby. He's getting up there, isn't he?
Oh, most definitely. And it's interesting. I'm doing the show now in my upstairs man cave here, and I'm looking at my bookcase right now, the top shelf of the bookcase. He's the first author with his books there. And I have all the other authors that I've actually known and talked about and who have written for Gridiron Greats, like Martin Jacobs, Mark Speck, Joe Jagorski, and a few other guys. All their books are on that top row, and I appreciate it, and I'm glad I have that connection with them all. And it's great, and it's great to see their information and the like. All right, we got about a minute. Again, if you're not subscribed to Gridiron Greats Magazine, what are you waiting for? Check out our website, GridironGreatsMagazine.com. Final thoughts, 20 seconds, Joe.
Great show. Can't believe it's been a month, Captain. We got to do this more often.
I know. I had some scheduling. I'm still working on a longtime collector, but our schedules keep getting messed up. So I'll be contacting you on that. And we've got a few other in the works. We're out of time. Thanks for listening, and hopefully we'll be back very soon with our next show. GridironGreatsMagazine.com.
Hey there, Sports History fan. This is Arnie Chapman, a.k.a. the Football History Dude, and I wanted to thank you for stopping by to listen to another episode here on the Sports History Network. Our podcasters are passionate about uncovering and sharing sports stories from yesteryear. And if you didn't know it already, we have over 30 shows across the network covering all sorts of sports history topics. In fact, here's a glimpse into one of our awesome podcasts here on the network.
Do you wish you knew more about the 100 seasons of the NFL? You're in luck because you found the Football History Dude podcast, where each episode is a journey back in time to learn about the rich history of the NFL. From the founding of the league in an auto showroom, all the way to what it is today, America's favorite sport and a behemoth of an industry. My name is Ernie Chapman. Football is my passion, and I want you to come along with me each week to explore the yesteryear of the gridiron. So hop on board my DeLorean, and let's get this baby up to 88 miles per hour.
How about that? I bet you're super hyped to go listen to that new podcast, right? Well, to learn about this show and all the other podcasts on the network, head over to sportshistorynetwork.com/podcast. Again, that's sportshistorynetwork.com/podcast. Head over there today to find your next favorite sports history podcast.